You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Art, Aristotle, and Anthony Hopkins. Hi, everyone. I'm your host, Sean Chandler, and you're listening to Your Program Is Your Ticket, a discussion of smaller theater works and the people and organizations that make it happen. Today's guest is Artistic Director Jerome Davis of Burning Coal Theater Company. Artistic Director Davis is part of my Theater Is For Everyone series, where I'm interviewing theater artists outside of the major locales and influences to give them a chance to be heard, discuss their triumphs, challenges, and misconceptions. Based in Raleigh, North Carolina, Burning Coal Theater Company produces literate, visceral, affecting theater that is experienced, not simply seen. Keep in mind that our interviews are recorded at different times to optimize schedules, just in case the audio sounds different. I'm super excited, so let's bring them on.
Hi, Jerome, and welcome to Your Program Is Your Ticket.
Good to see you today.
Oh, thank you. It's great to see you. I'm super excited that you're on the show. I'm very, very much looking forward to speaking with you about your theater company.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, let's start by having you introduce yourselves to our listeners and tell us about your background and where you're from and school or anything like that.
Sure. Happy to do that. I'm Jerome Davis. Jerry is fine. I'm the artistic director, the founding artistic director of Burning Coal Theater Company in Raleigh, North Carolina. My wife, Simi Kastner, and I founded the company back in the 90s. We met in New York City, where we'd both been living separately and then together for about a dozen years. And she had an interest in theater as a young person, particularly in set design. She wanted to study that, but she found that she likes to say back before the earth cooled, back in the 70s, that a lot of the educational facilities, including the one that she was enrolled in, didn't want women working in that field, and were very clear with her that they did not think that was appropriate for her, and they basically kind of ran her out of the business. So she went to American University in D.C., where her mother was working as a administrative assistant there to one of the deans, and so she was able to get free tuition. But she had been told that American University had a very good painting program, so she got a degree in computer science and another degree in painting, thinking, you know, again, back in the 70s, that those two fields would never interrelate in any way. And flash forward 45 years and the computer revolution and the digital age, and now having a degree as a painter is considered a great boon in the business that she works in. So she's the one who makes all the money in our family. But she also has a love for theater and probably never would have gone back to it had we not bumped into each other one New Year's Day morning in Manhattan. And shortly afterward, I popped the question, do you want to go south and help me start a theater? And she said yes, to my astonishment. And we did. And we've been here for 25 years now.
Oh, that's outstanding. I think it's so, I don't know, theater sort of has a weird educational landing spot. I don't know why. I remember I had a friend, this is back probably a couple decades, maybe 25 years ago, who was going to Cal State Fullerton in California, because I'm from Southern California. Yeah. And he wanted to be a director, and he actually had to go in and design his own directing program. It's crazy. And then to hear about this, what your wife went through.
Yeah.
I hope that we've come a long way. I really do.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's been a huge, I think she would basically own the university now.
Right.
Somebody said to her, one of the teachers said to her, a woman can't drive a nail as well as a man. How could you possibly make an A in my class? And proceeded to give her a B, even though she aced every test, showed up to every class and did every project on time. And he gave her a B, you know. And today, if you did that, you'd be out pretty quick. But so I do think we've come a long way about that. The educational component dates back at least to Aristotle, you know, who said, mm-hmm. art is something that entertains while educating. And so if you're making art, you are by definition involved in education, at least by Aristotle's terms, as well as the entertainment component to it.
Okay. I'm writing that down because I love that quote from Aristotle.
He was a pretty smart guy, it turns out. And then I didn't answer your question at all. I realize I'm originally from Tennessee, from Middle Tennessee. It came from a fairly poor family. I was the first person in our family in the 20th century to graduate from college, for instance. My two brothers followed me in that pursuit, and both are theater people too. My twin brother is a high school drama teacher in Tennessee, and my younger brother is a college drama professor in Kentucky. So we're slowly taking over the southeastern United States from a theatrical standpoint.
Right.
Yeah. And then I moved to New York when I was in my early 20s. And, you know, I spent about 11 or 12 years working as an actor first. You know, mostly when you go to New York, you want to be an actor if you're in the theater. But eventually I began to realize that I also was interested in directing. And you know, I always tell the story when I was a kid, most kids when they get bored in class, you know, they doodle geometric patterns around the edges of their paper or something. I was doodling seasons. You know, I was saying, what if we put Richard III there instead? What would that do? You know, I'm getting very excited about that kind of thing. And so that was probably, I should have seen that red flag waving saying, you're going to be an artistic director someday. So got to New York, met my wife, did a lot of work in regional theaters, not a lot, but enough, you know, to call myself an actor. And then, of course, worked a little bit in Manhattan as well. And you know, met some very interesting people while I was there, and some of whom have continued and are kind of the foundation or building blocks of our theater company here.
Wow, that's great. So let's talk about your theater company.
Sure.
Tell us about it. Tell us about Burning Coal Theater Company, please.
Well, it's you know, it's a small company. We were an itinerant company for the first I think 11 years that we were here in Raleigh. We bounced around finding spaces, opening spaces. There's a theater now called the Kennedy Theater in downtown Raleigh that had been a rehearsal room and storage space in the big performing arts center. And we talked the city into letting us use it as our home base for a while. And the result is that they put a bunch of money in eventually after we left, of course, but they put a bunch of money into redoing it and turning it into a performance space. So we built that one. We once performed in a tire shop, a place where you'd go to get your tires repaired. Did a John Guare play there. You know, like one does, you know.
Of course, yes.
But eventually we found our own space. I think the critical element has been for us has been the mission statement. And when I started here, I would never have thought that was the case. You know, I thought that was just, frankly, BS, you know, that you put on a grant to make yourself sound more highfalutin than, you know, but basically we're just trying to do plays. But what I found over the years is that our mission really, because it's very solid and very, very clear, I think, you know, I've seen some mission statements that say things like we want to save the world or change the world or something. And I'm like, okay, how are you going to pull that off? But ours, I think, has been very clear and very simple and direct. And so we are able to follow it. You know, we're able to look at it in the context of a play that might be under consideration and then go from there. So I think the mission statement is critical. Our mission is literate, visceral, and affecting theater. And each of those words has a specific meaning in our minds. The other thing that I was certain about, I had the good fortune of working when I was acting in New York. I'm an equity actor, and I got a season at Trinity Rep in Providence, just out of a blind cattle call. You know, I didn't have an agent at the time, and I went up there to Providence. I couldn't get any of my friends to go with me because they kept saying, Providence, why would you want to work there? And I knew who Adrian Hall was, you know, and I knew their company's history. I knew that Adrian had won the first Outstanding Regional Theater Tony Award, and that he had taken over the Dallas Theater Center and run both of them simultaneously for 6 years. In other words, he was a madman. And I knew he had recently left the company. They brought Ann Bogart in for a year after that, and that ended disastrously. And then they brought Richard Jenkins in, you know, the who most of us know now as a film actor. Richard was the artistic director for 4 years there, and he'd been in their company along with these great, great actors like Peter Garrity and Dan Von Bargen, rest in peace, just amazing people. And so I said, well, hell, if I have any chance of getting into that company, I'm going to rent a car and drive up to Providence, you know, and audition. And I did. There were about 300 people there, and I got cast. I was the guy that Richard hired out of that cattle call for the season, and got to work with some amazing directors and actors, but also I got to be in their space. You know, I don't know how much you want to hear about this, but Eugene Lee is the house designer there. Most people know Eugene's work. He did the original Sweeney Todd on Broadway. He did Wicked more recently. He does all the Saturday Night Live sets. He's one of a couple of house designers on Saturday Night Live. He's like Adrian, a bit of a madman, and his idea of theater is, you know, the minute you step in the building, you're in the world of the play. And Adrian Hall's motif was, no, it's just two guys sitting at a table talking. That's all I need. And somehow the two of them came together, Eugene just out of RISD, the Rhode Island School of Design, and Adrian having been brought in to turn this community theater, which is what it was back in the 60s, into a professional company. And the two of them met, not unlike, I think, you know, Lennon and McCartney or somebody like that, and they had such different values, but together they created a house style that led to the creation of their performing space. They have two, but the big one, the one upstairs, is just an extraordinary place to watch a play. And it's almost always, I mean, it's flexible, but it's almost always done either in the round or in thrust configuration. And the value of that was something that was very important to me. The experience of performing on that stage in that room, with the audience wrapped around me, and was something that I had never really fully understood before. This was back in the early 90s, before the, you know, Shakespeare's Globe was reopened and things like that. And I think people had sort of gotten out of it had gone out of fashion to do that kind of theater. Everything was proscenium. But if you go back in history, almost everything was done like that up until, you know, around the 1800s when we moved indoors. You know, we started doing performances indoors. If you think about the Greek amphitheaters, you know, the audience is wrapped, not fully, but to some degree wrapped around the stage. Certainly the Globe and the Rose and all those Elizabethan theaters, you know, when they would go out on the road with their wagons, you know, and perform in the countryside, the town would not all sit on one end of the yard and look at the stage. They would wrap around the stage, you know, and that's, you know, the way theater was done for thousands of years up until the last couple of hundred years. And so people think today that the proscenium is the traditional way of doing theater, but in fact, it's the Johnny come lately, you know. So I wanted that to be a part of our space once we got our space. And I understood the value of a space with an identity, you know, with a texture and a life and, you know, a character. And we got really, really lucky when we got here. We were told, look at this old building, the Murphy School. We heard that it was full of asbestos, that other companies had looked at it. But I happen to know that it was built in 1908, which was before there was anything called asbestos, you know. And so I kept thinking, maybe it's not, won't be so bad. Let's try it. And we did. We were able to, at that time, our budget was only about $300,000. And we were able to save or raise $1.5 million, which is five times our annual budget, and about that much again in in-kind contributions from people here in the community in order to renovate this very small space and turn it into what I think is the most dynamic theater space in North Carolina, honestly.
Wow. I truly believe that it's smaller, more independent theater companies and productions that have brought back those and highlighted those types of stages, thrust stages and theater in the round. And upon discovering that, I think it's exciting to people who aren't necessarily, you know, quote unquote theater people. They show up and it's like, wow, they're right there and they're all over the place. And, it's very, very intriguing.
I had a woman say to me once after a performance, she came up and said, "It was like I was in the room with them."
Exactly. Right.
you were in the room with them.
I think the only type of theater we have like that in New York is Circle in the Square.
Which is a problematic space in a lot of ways, but because it's so darn long. But I've seen some great stuff there over the years.
Oh, sure. Yeah. That's one of my very, very favorite theaters.
And the Classic Stage Company down on the Lower East Side has got a thrust stage too, unless it's been changed recently. That's a terrific space, I think. Classic Stage.
Oh yeah, yeah. The off and off Broadway spaces. Yeah. They have incredible stages. I think that a small stage and a limited situation like that is a huge asset to a production because, and I've said this many, many times, when you feel like you're limited is when I believe you get the most creative.
Yeah.
You know, right. Some people come up with genius ideas, to compensate for limitations and they're, sometimes I'm blown away by it. Like, wow, how did they figure that out? And why and what led them to that. And it was somebody who had to think a little bit harder about the idea than just, you know, throwing something big up on stage and
putting a bunch of money into it. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a great story about that that I absolutely love about Peter Hall, you know, who was running the National Theater. Peter Schaffer, who wrote Amadeus, had written his first big play was called The Royal Hunt of the Sun. And he gave it to Peter Hall to read. And a couple of weeks later, Hall called him into his office. And there's a stage direction in The Royal Hunt of the Sun that says they cross the Andes. And Schaffer walked in and he said, Peter, before you say anything, I just want to say, if you want me to cut that stage direction, I will. And Hall said, if you cut that stage direction, I won't do it. Mm. And I thought, that's an artistic director. You know, that's somebody who understands the value of what you're talking about, of creativity and imagination. And that in the theater, you know, we don't come there to have everything explicitly told to us. We come there to imagine and to really to be a part of the story. And no better way to do that, I think, than wrapping yourselves around the actors. And so it isn't just that you're watching the actors from close up. I mean, that's part of it, but you're also watching your neighbors watch the actors too. And so there's a community conversation going on when you're in a thrust configuration or an in the round configuration that I think isn't possible in a proscenium stage.
Wow. As a writer, I usually explain because I write plays and I write film and TV scripts, but I usually explain it this way. With a film, you're pretty much spoon feeding the audience everything that they need to know. And you could do it artistically and you know, subtly. There's a certain art to that. But with a play, it's almost like you're presenting a puzzle to the audience. Mm-hmm. That they need to figure, who is that and why is that person? I mean, I think if you did that sort of thing, if you spoon fed people during a play, it's just not going to be that effective. I mean, they're in front of you and they need to become engaged. So you have to sort of tickle their minds a little bit.
There's a great YouTube, one of those, I think, TED Talks that Oscar Eustace did a few years ago. I don't know if you've seen that one, where he talks about the fact that theater as we know it, Thespis, when he stepped out and became the first actor, that happened in the same city in the same decade as democracy, as the idea of democracy was created, that we know, you know, in the Western world at least. And he talks about it. Oscar Eustace says, you know, before that, everything had been directed toward the audience. And so the audience was being lectured. And there's a relationship between the lecturer and the lecturee. And then Eustace says, but what if I do this? And then he turns his head sideways, like he's talking to another actor. And he says, now I'm not lecturing to you. Now you have the control, because now you're watching me and judging me and assessing me and determine whether what I'm saying makes sense to you or not. And that's what democracy is, really. It's a group of people working out among themselves what they think is right and true and fair. And so I think Oscar Eustace is a very bright man. He also ran Trinity Rep for a while after I left. There's some kind of weird thing going on in Providence, but the idea that theater and democracy are interrelated is not a far-fetched idea, I think, at all.
Yeah. Is he still at the Public? I don't know.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, he sure is.
Yeah, he's. Yeah, I agree. Can we go back to Richard Jenkins? I have to say, I love that guy. I think he is such a dynamite actor. He's amazing. I remember him first sort of like registering to me, although I'm sure he did work way before that, in 6 Feet Under, which is a terrific show. And he was great. Yeah. He played the father. Yeah. And then most recently, The Humans. I thought he was outstanding. He was in the film version of The Humans.
Yes. Yeah.
And I have to say, I didn't really connect very much to the play version, but I loved the film version. And it just the acting was dynamite, starting with him.
I have to see it. I haven't seen that yet. But, you know, Richard came out of Indiana, I think Indiana University, back in the 60s. And he was he went to Providence, and he was one of the actors that Adrian brought in. There's an interesting story about that. They were doing a play called The Suicide, which is a farce by the Russian writer Erdman. Richard was playing the lead in it. It's a comedy about a farce about a guy who's despondent and tells everybody he's about to kill himself. And they start selling advertising for the event. And he finds that he's now too rich to die. So he has to fake his suicide. And it's, you know, hilarity ensues. But Richard did this show. And I think it was Variety, if I'm not mistaken. It was one of those big, West Coast arts magazines sent a reviewer to see it, I think because they had brought in a Russian director to direct it, some, you know, hotshot Russian director, probably from the Moscow Art Theater or something. And this writer wrote a review, and he said, and this was back in the 70s, he said, I'm convinced, having seen this play, that Richard Jenkins is the best actor in America today, which is quite a statement, you know. But Richard, you know, loved theater, and so he stayed with that company for decades, and only finally, when I was there, he was auditioning for Silence of the Lambs, and he didn't get it. He was down to two people. He was playing one of the FBI guys, you know, and he didn't get it. And he was pretty despondent. You know, he thought, oh, I'll never get a role. You know, he thought he wasn't good enough, which of course is absurd. But I think Anthony Heald got that role. And anyway, Richard is just a fantastic person, too. When I came up there, he invited me to stay in his house with him. I didn't take him up on it. I should have. I wish I had now. But he, you know, he said, you know, if you don't want to get an apartment, you can just stay at our place, you know. And I was like, well, I don't want to put you out, you know, Southern boy, you know, trying to be polite. I should have said, hell yes, I'll stay in your house, Richard. But anyway, he's a good guy. He's as good a guy as he is an actor, I think.
That character's name is Dr. Chilton. I fucking love the science. They play it all the time out here now on A&E. I mean, yeah. Probably about a good 2 months before Halloween, they play it. They play it over the summer. And I will watch it with commercials and, you know, bleeping and stuff every single time. I love that movie.
I'm on the other end of the spectrum. I've seen it once, and I ain't ever going back to that baby again. I loved it, but I'm not going to put myself through that again. Oh, anyway, sorry.
I would have loved to have seen him play Dr. Chilton. Yeah. Opposite Anthony Hopkins and Jodie Foster. I love Jodie Foster. I'm a huge fan of her. Yeah. She's great. Tell us in detail about the Murphy School. Like, give us its full history and how you got involved and where it is now. And
sure. Well, the location is important. It's I like to say it's two blocks from the governor's mansion and two blocks from the Krispy Kreme. So almost everybody knows where at least one of those places is, you know, so it's easy to direct people to it. It's also right on the border of what has historically been the African-American section of Raleigh, you know, in downtown Southeast Raleigh. And there's about five colleges that are within walking distance of the theater, including two historically black colleges, Shaw and St. Augustine's. It's accessible, you know, it is accessible. There's a big parking lot outside, a state employees parking lot, that's free after 5 p.m. and on weekends. So we don't have to worry about people paying for parking. If you're paying $85 a ticket at the big performing arts space downtown, a $5 parking cost is not that big a deal. But if you're paying $15 or $20 for a ticket like it is for us, then it's a big percentage of, you know, what you're going to be paying that evening. And so we got lucky in that regard. The building's history is fascinating. It was an elementary school. It's sort of a U shape, and the theater is one leg of the U. So it's about one third of the building. The other two thirds were the classrooms, which were converted into low income senior housing back in the 1990s, I think it was. But it was the event that happened here at the Murphy School in the auditorium in the summer of 1960 that makes the building historically important and perhaps the most important building in the city. And that is that the city school board met in the summer of 1960 and voted to begin the desegregation of the Raleigh school system. So there was a hugely important historical event. And in fact, the first African-American student to attend up to that point, white school in Raleigh was a 7-year-old named Bill Campbell, who went on to become the mayor of Atlanta. He served two terms as the mayor of Atlanta. His brother, Ralph, was the state auditor here in North Carolina for years, and his family had been highly involved in the NAACP and other, you know, political organizations. So it's fascinating. You know, we closed our first season here with a play that we commissioned and did ourselves about that history and all of the political machinations that went on and all of the kind of slightly terrible, well, more than slightly, the terrible things that this family and another family, the Holt family, had to deal with in trying to get their sons into a white school in Raleigh. I'll give you one example. There was a man, he was still alive at the time, and so we were able to interview him. He's since passed on, but he ran a bail bond company in downtown Raleigh that was, you know, primarily used by the African American community. There were lots of marches and protests and street, you know, activities going on, and he didn't participate in them. And he told us, you know, he was in his 80s at the time, that he had felt guilty ever since then for not participating in those things. And everybody told him, and I think rightfully so, you got to stay here. You know, we need you here in the bail bond place because they're going to arrest us. And we're going to need you to bail us out, to help us get bailed out. And he understood that intellectually, but emotionally, he felt guilt about it, about not having got out on the street with the others. And so that those kinds of stories were woven into the play that we did. A local playwright named Ian Finley, who's really fantastic, holds a master's in playwriting from NYU and is just a brilliant mind. He wrote the play, and we did it here, and it was very emotional, and I think a darn good piece of theater too, if I may say. So anyway, the building has, you know, so we raised the money. It's set for about 32 years, I think, after it closed down in the 1970s. It just sat here falling apart. There were pigeons in here and, you know, squirrels and stuff like that, and the holes in the floor, broken windows. And there was no HVAC, no electricity, no plumbing, no nothing. We had to put it all in. And I wanted to get a balcony in the space. I wanted a balcony on three sides, and we did get that. We snuck it in 1 inch under code. You know, the building with the ceiling's about 20 feet high, and if it had been 19 feet, 11 inches, we wouldn't have been able to put the balcony in, but we did squeeze it in. And it's just it has great acoustics, which is not something we really had anything to do with. It just does for whatever reason. And it works. I was standing in the lobby after a play had just ended, and I was standing out in the lobby, and the door burst open. The audience came streaming out, and this one woman walked past me, and she said, not even to me, she just sort of said it to herself as she walked by. She said, "That room loves a play." And I thought, I could win all the awards in the history of the world, and it will not be better than that comment. You know, that's what you want. If you're running a theater, you want the audience to feel like they're in the world of the play, you know, I think. And The Room does it over and over again. It somehow becomes the world of the play. I don't know. It's mysterious, but I guess many of the good things in life are. So anyway, that's a little bit about the building.
Very, very nice feedback to hear from an audience member, just sort of offhand.
Yeah.
I love those moments. Please reiterate the title of Ian's play one more time for us.
It was called 1960,
okay,
which was the year that the vote took place.
Okay, great. Outstanding. I see that you're doing art right now.
Yes, we are.
Okay. Talk about that.
Oh, sure. First of all, it's a damn good play. I was listening to it the other night. I didn't direct this one. We hired a gentleman named Ken Hinton, who teaches at North Carolina Central, one of the historically black colleges here, or university in this case, in the Triangle. And he's done a lot of stuff with us over the years in other capacities. And he is a director. He runs his own company called the Agape Theater Project. Ken is working with three African-American actors who are three of the best actors in the Triangle and certainly three of the best we have access to. They're just tailor-made for these roles. And so honestly, when the time came to do the play, they were the three that I thought of. And I wasn't thinking of it like, you know, what does this do to the play or anything? How does this speak to the current moment or anything like that? I was just thinking, I want to see these three guys together on stage in something. And when Art came to mind, you know, it just fit like a glove. You know, there was no way that we weren't going to do it at that point. And it's turned out well. You know, it's an interesting play. There's a moment in it, near the end, when one of the characters says it's sad that we have reached a point where we can't even understand each other anymore. And I thought, did she write this yesterday? You know, it seems so relevant right now. The play does. And yet it's a comedy and the audience is laughing, you know, a lot. And I think that's something that maybe people need a little bit right now as well.
Indeed. Tell us about the actual play. Tell the audience about the story, the plot line.
Sure. The writer is Yasmina Reza, who is a French writer. It was adapted by Christopher Hampton into the English language. It's about three middle-aged men who were friends of long standing. And they occupy kind of roles in each other's lives. You know, there's the sort of middle brow one. There's the kind of not very. It isn't that he's not bright, but he's a bit of a coward. He kind of goes along with whatever anybody else says. And then there's the intellectual. You know, those three and the middle brow guy decides as the play begins to buy a hugely expensive abstract painting that really looks a whole lot like just a white canvas. You know, he insists that there's more to it than that, but it looks pretty much like a white canvas. And so to their astonishment, to the three of them's astonishment, this really creates turmoil in their relationship, in the relationship of all three of them. And so I think it's about how we play roles, and what it takes to shed those roles, and is it worth it? You know, is it worth that turmoil to shed those roles, or would it be better just to hang on to them? And I don't know. I mean, I don't think the play really comes down on one side or the other on that, but it certainly makes me think. It's an extraordinary work of art, really. It really is.
It is. She, for the audience sake, she also wrote a play that was turned into a movie called God of Carnage. Yeah. And there's something about her writing to me that just floats. Yeah. And I remember I've taken two acting classes in my life. I took them to have, as a writer, to have empathy for the actor, to make sure that what I'm asking them to do up there, you know, short of crossing deserts, is possible.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a play called Lifetimes 3.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. Yeah. And it was done in New York on Broadway with Helen Hunt and John Turturro.
I think Gambone did it in London. Michael Gambone, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, wow. That I didn't know.
I think that's right.
But it's the story of like three different... It's one scenario told three different ways with almost exactly the same dialogue, yeah, but just shifts in tone and intention. And that really, to me, stood out because I thought in everything that I've read or seen by her, everybody's a little bit of a hero and everybody's a little bit of a villain at the same time. And that's just a great, in my opinion, yeah, formula for creating three-dimensional, interesting characters.
You can thank Shakespeare for that. Right. There's a great book called Shakespeare and the Creation of the Human Being by Harold Bloom that posits the idea that Shakespeare was the first writer to create non-stock characters that didn't just fit into one slot and stay there throughout the play. So, yeah, but Yasmina Reza does that well. Art and God of Carnage are two really good examples of it. It's painful, you know, it's painful to, because we all think of ourselves as being one thing, but we're not. We all have different aspects of ourselves. And that's where, you know, I think, Sean, fairness comes into play. People are often ask me, what is the one thing you value most in a work of art? And I always say fairness. You know, I'm not interested in propaganda. I'm not interested in telling a story that people want me to tell or that will make people happy. I'm interested in does the play look at the world fairly and give voice? One of the writers I really love is David Hare. Who's a little to the left of Mao Zedong, you know, when it comes to politics, if you read any of his essays or personal diaries or any of that stuff. But then he writes these plays with these great conservative characters in them. And you know, with just, it just blows everybody else away. It's kind of like Shaw did with Major Barbara, you know, with that shot of or whatever the guy's name was, who comes in at the end of the play and just destroys all of Barbara's arguments, you know, and I'm like, that's what the world is. You know, the world, if it was easy, if you could just say those people over there with the red hats, those are the good guys, and those people with the blue hats, those are the bad guys, or vice versa, you know, that'd be an easy thing, you know, but that's not what the world is. And I think Yasmina Reza is one of the primary, it's very subtle, you know, her work is very subtle, but she really understands that maybe better than most writers today.
Oh, I concur. And by the way, Christopher Hampton, who is a translator, is dynamite.
Yeah.
He really knows how to capture her work and translate it properly to where everything that she's saying, that she's asking us to think, that she's asking us to feel, it's all there. It remains. Nothing ever gets lost in translation. He's just dynamite.
Right? He's also working with Florian Zeller now, who did the Father and the Son, and there are a bunch of different plays with titles of that nature that he has translated as well. So he's good with those writers, and he's good with the French language too. Yeah, he's something else.
The Father was great. I don't know if you saw it here, but it was dynamite with Frank Langella. Was he? And it was just the way it was done. I don't want to give anything away about that play because it's just so brilliant and beautiful. And then Anthony Hopkins, there he is again in our conversation. Oscar for it. I haven't seen the movie, but let's just talk about
Anthony Hopkins the whole time. That could fill up at least an hour, right? The first play I ever directed that wasn't, you know, me and my brothers in our basement was The Lion in Winter, you know, and that was Hopkins' first film role, I think, playing maybe, which one did he play, Jeffrey? I can't remember, but he was a baby at the time. So
it'll be Sean and Jerome and the Anthony Hopkins show.
I like
we'll analyze Anthony Hopkins the entire time.
Let's do it.
That's hilarious. What's your criterion for selecting your material? What has to be there?
I mentioned that idea of fairness, is something that I value greatly. And, frankly, I think that the role of an artistic director, they don't call them managing directors or presidents or, they call them artistic directors. And so I think the reason for that is that my role in the role of an artistic director is the same role as an artist, really. It's just a different way of creating art. So honestly, I read and I see as much as I can. If something moves me, then I trust that it will move the audience as well. Of course there are other considerations, I wouldn't do Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf if I didn't have a Martha, have reasonable expectation of getting one. I wouldn't do Lear without a Lear, in mind at least. And sometimes you have an actor in mind and they can't do it or they won't do it or they're not available to do it and you end up scrounging. But I think you have to, you have to love the play first. You have to love it enough to spend 18 months or so of your life working on it. And then you have to, make sure that it's within the possibility of your company's resources to do. And that almost always has to do with picking up the right director. Because as we talked about with the Peter Hall, Peter Schaffer moment, any good director can take something difficult and make it dramatic and interesting without massive resources, which we honestly don't have as a small company. You know, we have decent resources, but we don't have massive resources. And so throwing money at something is never an answer. And frankly, it works. One of the actors here in town told me recently that it was a guy from New York that we bring in a lot to do shows. He's a really brilliant actor named Brian Linden. And he told me that every time he came here to do a play, he felt like he was coming to do something important. And I think that's important to actors. You know, actors, if you pay them enough money, they'll do the commercials or they'll do, an episode of a sitcom but that's not what artists want to do. What artists want to do is something important. And so we have always tried to make sure that the plays we're doing are important for that moment in time. And sometimes you don't know why. Like, I didn't know why art was important to do. And maybe it's self-aggrandizing, but I was sitting there the other night listening to the play and I heard that line and I went, okay, now I know why I wanted to do this. You know, now I know why this was the right play at the right moment. So I think if you are willing to trust yourself and if you're willing to do the work, one more brief story, second or third year of a company here in town that has since folded, the artistic director called me one day and said, I was just wondering if you had any ideas for plays that I could do this year. This was, I think, in the guy's second season. And I wanted to go, dude, if you don't have them lined up on the runway for 10 years, you should forget it. I could put 10 seasons together right now. And I none of them would ultimately come true. But there are that many plays that I want to do right now because I've read them. I've seen them. I've read about them. There are two really great resources for that that I want to recommend to people. If anybody's still listening to me jabbering on at this point on the podcast, one is American Theater Magazine, which most people know about. And the other one is Theater Record, which is published, or at least it was published in England. I think they've now gone to an all digital format, but essentially they collect every review of every play done in London over a fortnight, over a two-week period. And they compile them together. And so, you open the magazine and it's like, Tom Stoppard's Leopold Stadt, and then there are 10 reviews of it, and you don't read them all, of course, but you get a pretty good idea of what the play's about and whether it's working as a piece of literature. And so the next time you're at the drama bookshop, or if you're in London at the National Theatre's bookstore or something like that, or just online, you might have you've got a list of plays you want to buy and read for yourself, or just sit there in the bookstore and read them if you can't afford to buy them. And so those two resources, American Theatre and Theatre Record, are critical resources, I think, for any artistic director, especially given that so much of what gets done today in New York starts out in London. It's just the truth of it. I think it's because their public subsidy for the arts is so much greater than ours. But they just have about 8 or 9 great publicly subsidized theaters, and almost all of them do new work. From the tiny Bush Theater to the National and everything in between, they all do new works now, which means there are playwrights out there that that understand that they have a place to for their work to be done if they do it, you know, which was not true for most of really most of the first half of the 20th century. And then I could launch now into a big story about how that came about, but I don't want to bore you more with that. But suffice to say, in my lifetime, it has become possible for a playwright like yourself to know that if you write a good enough play, there is someone to do it in England. And I don't know if it's true here so much. You know, I hope it is, but I certainly don't see it to the degree that I see in England.
Can I make, by the way, you're not boring me at all. I'm actually really fascinated by the interview, but can I digress a little and make a recommendation for something in London right now?
Yes.
Please. That I loved. Right now, my husband David and I flew there literally, like, we got back here literally just before the shutdown of all theater for COVID. But when we were there, we saw this great new musical called Anne Juliet.
Yeah.
And have you heard of it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's still on the West End, I think. Or
it is. They just reopened it. Yeah. And it's the story of what happens, since we're talking about Shakespeare, to Juliet after, like, say she doesn't die. Say she decides, I've only known this guy for like a weekend, and I want to live and I want to go see what's occurring in the world. And yeah. I know everyone hates these, but it's a jukebox musical and it is dynamite. I remember I was like really kind of sitting in my seat like, yeah, go ahead and impress me. By the end of the first act, I was, you know, crying and standing ovation and all that.
That's fabulous.
Anybody who goes to London, you should see that. I believe it won like a shit ton of Olivier's too. It's great.
That's fabulous.
It is. What are some of the challenges that Burning Coal Theater as a regional theater company face over larger theater companies and ensembles?
Oh, well, you know, I think that we have a lot of competition, and I don't think any of it is the other theaters. Frankly, my wife is fond of an old saying that is said, the best place to build a shoe store is across the street from a shoe store. And so I don't think of the other theaters in this area as competition. I think there is competition, though. I think the professional hockey team down the road is competition. The college basketball team, you know, the movie complex is all over town, and restaurants and, you know, television and Netflix and stuff like that. The biggest worry that I have, honestly, is something that's a bit esoteric and maybe a little of a broad idea that may not fit into your question, but I'm concerned about, how can I put this delicately, stupidity. There's a lot of people out there making money off of dumb right now, you know, you see it in, I don't know, I heard recently that the of the 10 most watched television programs last year, like 8 of them were football games. And I love football games, you know, I love watching all that stuff, but in moderation. And I think we've gone way, way past moderation where sports is concerned in our country. There's a line in a play where somebody says, at least we don't put sports on our front pages. And the other person says, we do put them on our front pages. We just turn it around and call it the back page. That's what everybody reads. And you know, of course, everybody needs some outlet, you know, but we drink too much. We take too many drugs. We dishonor education. instead of honoring it. You can't turn on the television without hear or the radio without hearing somebody say, "Well, I'm no brain surgeon," or "I'm no math major," you know, as if that were some kind of diminishing comment, you know, about those people. What they're really saying is, "But I have real intelligence," and I just don't think that idea serves our community. And I think we're seeing it in big ways right now. And so you have to ask yourself, who is benefiting from that? You know, I could go on forever, but we live in a very sort of militarized society, where this idea of nationalism seems to be taking a greater and greater chunk of our focus and attention. And for a long time, there was a battle going on there, but it seems like both sides of the political spectrum have given in to that idea these days. And there are very few people out there speaking against it, you know, saying, why the hell do we need to spend 60% of every dollar we give to the government in taxes on one of the 800 military bases we have around the world? Why do we need, how does that help me in any way? If I give a dollar to the government, I should get a dollar's worth of benefit, or close to it at least. And there's nobody in the mainstream talking about that. And I especially include our theaters. Our theaters are just sitting mum on this topic, and have done for, you know, the last 20 or 25 years. We're not writing the plays we used to write and telling the stories we used to tell at all. And maybe it's because we haven't had a Vietnam. You know, we've had these sort of boutique wars like Iraq, you know, where only a tiny fragment of society is involved with it. But in fact, we're all involved with it because our tax dollars are going there. I'll shut up after this one more comment. There was during the withdrawal from Afghanistan, the fact was generated that $2 trillion had been spent over the last 20 years in Afghanistan. And I got out my little calculator, and it turns out that $2 trillion over 20 years comes out to $230 million a day of our tax money that was being spent. $230 million a day was spent in Afghanistan. Now, what could that do for our society? For our infrastructure, you know, we talk about the bridge that collapsed in Pittsburgh. Well, maybe if we hadn't squandered that money for the last 20 years, we would not have had to worry about that, right? And on and on. I mean, I could go on all day with these things, but basically, I think our biggest competition is from people who would enrich themselves by peddling mediocrity and the lack of, dishonoring the idea of education, of reading, of books and, things that elevate the soul as opposed to drag them down into the muck. So there's my sermon, end of sermon, pass the plate around now.
That's funny. What do you think are some of the biggest misconceptions facing theater in North Carolina?
Do you mean from people outside North Carolina?
Right. What do you think people outside think versus what's actually occurring?
Well, I can tell you that we have never received a cent from the National Endowment for the Arts. In our 25-year history, despite multiple grant efforts. And when you look at the list of where the money's going, it's always New York, New York, Chicago, New York, New York, Boston, New York, San Francisco, L.A., New York, New York, Seattle, and then occasionally they'll drop in a Atlanta or Miami or, you know, Houston, Dallas maybe, you know, in other words, the giant metropolitan areas in the South. But it's usually one and done on those things. And it seems to me that I'm just going to be on my far left progressive soapbox for one more minute, that if this really were the National Endowment for the Arts, then they would be supporting the arts, not the artists, right? What matters is the people in this country, and the National Endowment for the Arts should be supporting the populations in this country who need it. And there is no region of the country that is more in need of art and the, you know, those sort of elevated ideas than the southeastern United States. You know, simple. And yet that's not the policy of the NEA. The policy is, you know, who's on our board of directors and how can we help ourselves by helping them? And I'm fed up with it, to be honest with you. I find it extremely antithetical to what they claim to be their mission. And, you know, so one idea that I think is misguided about North Carolina is that that it matters a damn how good our theaters are. What matters is that there are people here who need this service. And while, of course, we're not going to do a production as good as something the Guthrie might do with their $30 or $40 million budget, but we might do the best production somebody living here has ever seen, and we might change their lives. And that's what they ought to be funding. So I don't know if that quite answers the question about misconceptions, but I'm going to let it ride.
That answers it beautifully. I had no idea. And that feels criminal to me. It really does. I didn't know. And
well, I'm not saying nobody in North Carolina has gotten grants, but we haven't. And I don't know anybody who has, you know, honestly. Yeah.
Still, that's terrible. Yeah. How has Burning Coal Theater Company dealt with COVID-19?
That's a really good question. Cautiously, I hope. We had to cancel one production. It was scheduled to open the first week of April in 2020, and we did cancel it. We committed to the cast that we would bring it back as soon as we felt like it was safe to have five actors in a room rehearsing together. And we will. That was a play called Silent Sky by Lauren Gunderson. But since then, we have managed to do everything that we committed to do. We changed some titles. We were supposed to do 5th of July in the 2021 season, the Lanford Wilson play. We swapped it out for a one-person show. I don't know if we'll ever bring it back. We had done Tally's Folly the previous year, and I wanted to do the whole Tally trilogy in three consecutive seasons. And I don't know now, since, you know, we've lost that sort of momentum. I'm not sure that we'll ever come back with that, although I love that play. I hate to give it up so much. But right now, getting, you know, however many, 10 or 12 people in a room to rehearse a play like that just doesn't feel you know, smart or safe or conscientious. So we've tried to do that. And we've also tried to be creative about things. One of our guys, our master electrician here, came up with this weird little device. It cost maybe $200, I think, but it allows you to broadcast up to, I think it was up to 800 feet on an unclaimed FM radio dial number, you know. We were able to do a play in our parking lot with the audience sitting in their cars listening on their radio stations, you know, or their phone. You could dial in on your phone, too, because not everybody has radios in their cars anymore. But we were able to do the play out in the parking lot, but we also had some of it inside the theater. We have these big windows on that side of the building, and so you could see this sort of two-dimensional puppetry going on inside, and the actors were mic'd, and they were outside and moving around in the trees and stuff, you know. And we were able to do that because Barry Jacob, our master electrician, found this device that allowed you to do that. it's like a couple of $100 and as long as you've got body mics on the, we had in this case two actors, you know, it was pretty inexpensive to do, and people came, you know, we filled the parking lot for the show. We've done about three or four one person shows since then, which are obviously a lot safer to rehearse. And then when we've not done one person shows, we've done two or three character plays. Lauren Gunderson's I and You, or Eiffel Fugard's The Road to Mecca, or Art, which we're doing right now. So okay. And we did an outdoor show. We did a production of Evita last June that we did outdoors in a park in Raleigh. And that turned out to be safe. You know, the audience felt much safer there, watching outdoors.
Wow. So like a live drive-in of sorts.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
It's nice to have smart people working with you, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, especially in the tech end where I, right. which is over my head,
Yeah, I hear you. Okay, before we wrap up, do you want to do a speed round?
Oh, sure.
Okay. What's your favorite play?
I have two. Can I give you two?
You can.
One is The Road to Mecca by Eiffel Fugard, which I just directed, and the other is The Weir by Connor McPherson.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Favorite musical? You could do two of that, too, if you want.
I love Man of La Mancha. I'll weep like a stuck pig whenever I watch that play every time.
Well, that's a new one for the speed round. Favorite one-person show?
Oh, I did it myself. I don't give myself many roles here at the theater. I think I've only given myself three in all the time I've been running the theater. But there's a McPherson play, Connor McPherson, called St. Nicholas, about a theater critic and a coven of vampires. And that is one beautiful piece of writing, man. That is, if you've never read it, read St. Nicholas. You're talking about weeping. That is such a great piece of theater.
It's by McPherson?
Yeah, Connor McPherson. Yeah, okay. It was one of his early plays before he started writing. You know, he, basically all of his stuff early on was one person or in the case of this Lime Tree Bower, three monologues happening simultaneously or consecutively, I guess I should say.
Wow.
Yeah, he did a lot of that early on.
Cool. So before we wrap up, why don't you give our audience your social media information so they can keep up with you and your many endeavors?
Certainly. Our website is burningcoal.org, which is the main place to go for information. We're also on Instagram, and we're on we don't do a whole lot of Twitter, honestly, but we do have a YouTube channel. And we now have a TikTok channel, which I haven't even looked at yet. But we have some people under the age of 30 that are making sure those,
right.
those things function properly. And so it's, I think, Twitter is Burning Coal TC for theater company, and Instagram is, God, I'm not going to be able to read it, but I know it's there. I think it's BCT. 1214, maybe. I don't know. I'm not sure that's right. You can find us on Instagram, though, if you just Google Burning Coal Theater or search for Burning Coal Theater. And then TikTok is Burning Coal Theater, R-E, rather than E-R.
Wow. Very cool. TikTok. I think you're the first. Actually, no. I interviewed somebody for my last series, Act Two Places, who actually cast and brought in people for, like, a Zoom show that they were doing
sure.
off of TikTok. Of course, both of those people were like under 25.
Yeah, which I am if you multiply me by three. Also, we do a podcast series called Into the Fire, which is available on Podbean and also a couple of those other platforms where you can get podcasts. And that's, I think, quite nice. We've had some really interesting people on there.
Is it on your website as well?
Yeah, it is. It sure is.
Okay. I thought so. I thought I saw that there. this has been so cool. I have to show you something, and I'll explain it to the people in who can't see it. But this is the page of my script with all of the notes that I've taken from our conversation and all the cool things that I have learned. And I'm overwhelmed because it was just so much cool information, and I appreciate you bringing it to us, and I appreciate you bringing the point of view of theater in North Carolina and your own theater, which has done so much wonderful work, and I just want to thank you so much, Jerome, for. Sure. For being a guest on the podcast. You have been amazing.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I love to talk about myself.
Well, it's all been interesting, and that's the most important part when you look to talk about yourself. I always say, if somebody talks a lot, if they're interesting and funny, then go nuts. Well, okay, have a great day.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, folks, the 11 o'clock number has been sung and the bows have been taken, so it's time to lower the curtain. Once again, a big thanks to Artistic Director Jerome Davis of Burning Coal Theater Company. What a great conversation. You can find more episodes of Your Program Is Your Ticket on the Broadway Podcast Network, who has honored me with a place on their incredible theater podcast platform. Broadway Podcast Network is all about creating an engaging, immersive, user-friendly experience where theater stories of all kinds can be easily found, shared, and enjoyed. Please visit them on my landing page at bpn.fm/ypiyt. Again, that's bpn.fm/ypiyt. Your Program Is Your Ticket is also on Facebook at facebook.com, Your Program Is Your Ticket. I'm on Twitter at Program Ticket, Instagram at Your Program Is Your Ticket, YouTube at Your Program Is Your Ticket, iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, Podcast Addict, Podbean, Pocket Casts, Deezer, TuneIn, Listen Notes, and the UK-based theater platform Thespey. FYI, I appreciate all good ratings, reviews, and subscriptions. Folks, take a little time to visit theater websites and see what they have to offer. Watch their content, give them all great ratings and reviews, and most importantly, donate, donate, donate. As always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. And remember, theater is for everyone.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.